welcome to this edition of Cover to Cover. I'm your host, Eusebius McKaiser. You are in for a special edition today. We have a New York Times best-selling author who's written some of the most amazing young adult fiction over the last couple of years. And a little bit later in the show, you will also have a review of a really beautiful book that is situated in El Dorado Park, a work of fiction by Terry Ann Adams, Those Who Live in Cages, which I have asked social commentator Oliver Dixon to review. He didn't complete the book when he read it, and you will find out a little bit later in the show, what was it about the book? Is there something good about the book that made him not complete it, or was there something about it that didn't quite gel? But you'll have to wait till later. For now, I have recorded an interview with Angie Thomas, who wrote Concrete Rose, a really, really beautiful book in which a 13-year-old black boy is the protagonist. Angie Thomas is the author of this absolutely brilliant book, Concrete Rose. It is available here in South Africa. Please go and get a copy or buy one online. Make sure that you read it, you share it widely. It is absolutely stunning. It's in conversation with some of her other work. She is already an excellent international bestseller. And I think this book is one that will resonate with you for many, many reasons that we will explore over the next 18 minutes or so. Angie, congratulations on yet another brilliant piece of work. And thank you so much for coming on Cover to Cover.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Before we drill into some of the themes, without giving too much away, for someone who hasn't yet read Concrete Rose, just give them a basic précis of the storyline.
Yes, Concrete Rose takes place about 17 years before the events of The Hate U Give, my first novel, and it follows 17-year-old Maverick. Many of my readers will be familiar with his name because in The Hate U Give, he was Star's father. But in Concrete Rose, he's a 17-year-old kid who's still just known around the neighborhood for being the son of a former gang leader and drug dealer. But as his father is in prison, Maverick tries to help his mom out financially the best way he knows how, and that's by selling drugs for the King Lords gang. But when he finds out that he's the father of a three-month-old baby boy, Seven, he decides that he wants to try to turn his life around. But juggling fatherhood, school, trying to stay on the straight and narrow, and trying to help out financially, it becomes too much, and Maverick has to decide for himself what it truly means to be a man.
And there's just so many things that Maverick goes through and we journey with him. There is peer pressure at school and in the neighborhood. There is the difficulty of not having an easy exit option to get out of the gang territories, because there's a cost to choosing the ethical option and no longer being involved in illegality. There is the incredible pressure of whether or not to focus on school or to complete your daily hustle because you've got to provide for a baby that wasn't anticipated. It's an incredible tapestry of some of the social challenges that Black Americans face in general, but Black teenagers in particular.
Thank you. Thank you. Maverick has been probably the character I'm asked about the most, which surprised me, because he stars dad, and you don't usually get readers interested in the parents when it comes to young adult novels. Mm-hmm. But I think so many people were fascinated because he is someone who overcame so much. We know in The Hate U Give that he had this past, and we know it wasn't pretty. And we know he was dealing with all of these things that young Black men here in America in impoverished communities often face, but he overcame them and he became a wonderful, not just father and husband, but a community pillar. And so I thought it was very important to show redemption in a young man that so many people would probably write off. Mm. So it was so, so important for me to tell his story, to show beyond the stereotype of a young man like him.
I want to read randomly from chapter 10, just a little bit, and then I want to ask you a question. Spoiler alert, by the way, in some ways you'll enjoy the book, even if we tell you the details of the plot. But if you're one of those folks who don't like it, close your ears for 20 seconds, and then you can watch the rest of the conversation. A week ago, I sat in the street with Dre as he stared at nothing at all,
The Wyatts rushed outside first. Mrs. Wyatt called 911. Mr. Wyatt tried to get me to let Gray go. I wouldn't, couldn't. I held him until the ambulance came. The paramedics didn't try to save him. It's like they took one look at him and gave up. I cussed them out. Swore I'd kick their asses if they didn't do their job. See, they don't know my cousin like I do. He a fighter, man. I don't give a damn that a bullet was in his head. He would have come back. He would have. They put a white sheet over him and left him in the street. He wasn't a person no more. He was a crime scene. Besides the melancholy of tragedy in that scene, what strikes me the most, and it's actually, as a fellow writer, one of the things that I was most excited to talk to you about, is the register. What's remarkable about this book, and I hate the tag, although it's useful, of young adult genre, is that you write in the voice of a 17-year-old black teenage boy. The language, the tone is faithful to a teenage boy. Why did you make that choice, and was it difficult to achieve it?
I made that choice for a couple of reasons. On one, I wanted to validate the real Mavericks out there. So often, Black kids especially are made to feel as if they're either too much or not enough. They're made to feel as if the way that they speak is not acceptable. The way that they carry themselves is not acceptable. Their fashion choices, their music, blah, blah, blah. And the funny thing is, you know, when you look at it on a wider scale, they are copied the most. Their language, the way that they speak, it becomes hip and cool once it hits the mainstream. But when they're doing it, it's a problem. And I wanted to validate those young people who speak like Maverick. I wanted to give them a book where someone talks like them and we still understand what he's saying. He still gets his point across. You know, the fact that he may take an S off of a word here or there doesn't take away from his intelligence. So for one, I wanted to validate him. It wasn't as hard to write from that voice as I thought it was going to be because I've heard it my whole life. I know the real Mavericks. I grew up around them. That's how guys spoke in my neighborhood. I heard their inner thoughts, outer thoughts, all of it. And tapping into that and recalling that wasn't nearly as hard as I thought it would be. Creatively, it was easy. The hard part was allowing myself to do it and not worrying about how publishing would take it or how people outside of young Black men or young Black people in a neighborhood like that would perceive it. You know, you worry about that, those kinds of things sometimes. You worry about the white gaze and how this is going to be accepted by white people. And I had to push that aside and think about those real Mavericks and say, this is for them and everybody else is just a bonus. So you can go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm emoting because what you're saying is so beautiful. I'm trying to choke back. You know what's important about that, Angie, for me, which is another reason why your book is so important and having persisted with that choice. You know, in your society better than I do, often the first time Black teenage boys are rendered visible is when they have their first encounter with the criminal justice system. We don't see their innocence as children. We don't see them play. The most minor of infraction in school can lead to being disciplined or even being expelled. Many readers, I thought, would struggle to enjoy your book because of its excellence. That sounds counterintuitive, but I mean it in the sense that we are so unused to Black teenage boys being protagonists that it feels weird to read a book that centers a young Black boy the way that you had. And it makes sense to worry about the white gaze, the commercial gaze, or even to worry about what middle-class Black readers might think.
Absolutely.
I found it deeply, deeply moving and a really important piece of epistemic justice on behalf of Black teenagers.
Thank you. Thank you. That means everything to me. You know, as I was writing it, I think the realization hit me as well. We don't see enough stories told by Black boys, you know, about Black boys, featuring them at the center of their story. And something else too that I realized while writing this is we don't see a lot of instances of Black boys showing a full range of emotions.
Absolutely.
In fictional portrayals, you know, we don't see them crying on screen a lot. And that's such a human emotion. It's such a minor thing when you think about it, crying. Who hasn't cried before in their life? We all have. But can I name how many films can I name where, or television shows can I name where Black boys and men are given the space to cry on screen? And I realized, wow, it's not nearly enough. And it reminded me of the weight and the responsibility I have as an author and creator of further humanizing Black boys and Black men with my writing. And I'm sad that we're still at that point. I'm sad we're that we're still
progress,
at that point.
Though. We're getting there. I'm just as sad as you, but it's happy tears. One of my dearest friends, Musa Okonwa, who's a writer based in Berlin, has two books out this year, Lucky Bastard. And one of them is entitled, In the End, It Was All About Love. And it's about his journey of leaving London to go and escape in romantically thinking about Berlin as cosmopolitan. And then realizing that, you know, anti-Black racism is everywhere, even on the continent. Just as Baldwin discovered in France. But one of the things that Musa talks about is the first time he gave himself permission, and he's a very tall, lanky Black man. You can't miss him, not least in Europe, to give himself permission to cry in public. And it's so liberating, particularly as a man, but as Black men and Black youth in particular, to be allowed to emote. There's this beautiful scene between Mr. Wyatt, who's a really fascinating little moral character in the book, love him, more than little, really important, between him and Maverick, where Maverick basically pitches up at work and clearly the dude's been having marijuana and the old man can smell it on him and they have a conversation about why he's taking drugs. And he says he's basically trying to forget about the death of Dre. And the scene unfolds as follows. Mr. Wyatt don't say anything for a real long time. He sighs. Son, one of the biggest lies ever told is that Black men don't feel emotions. Guess it's easier to not see us as human when you think we're heartless. Fact of the matter is we feel things, hurt, pain, sadness, all of it. We got a right to show them feelings as much as anybody else. Then a little bit later in the scene, he allows himself to be vulnerable in the arms of the surrogate dad, effectively. And he just lets out and he says the following. Let it out, he says. The sound come out of me. And I don't know if I'm screaming or crying. I pull my shirt over my mouth, but that don't muffle the sobs. It only catch my tears. Small things can make a huge difference to the quality of our lives. Toxic masculinity has got so many foundations that it's predicated on. And I'm sure you'll agree with me, Angie, one of the many bitter fruit that sustain toxic masculinity in all of us, including us Black men, is the fact that no one gives us bloody permission to emote. Tell me why that scene is so crucial to this public agenda that I share with you to give Black kids permission to show emotion.
Yes, it's so important. It is absolutely important. It goes back to what I was just saying about humanizing Black people. You know, and I think Black men are dehumanized the most. You're seen more as threats first than human beings. We see that. We're seeing proof of that right now here in the States as we await the verdict on the Chauvin trial. So Black men are always seen as threats first. and never as human. And I think as a creative, the only thing I can hope to do is to further humanize. So it was so important for me to have that scene. It was so important for me to have someone give Maverick that permission, because it's not me coming down on his parents, but I can't say that anyone had ever given him that permission before that moment and broke it down for him and said, hey, it's okay for you to cry. And it's coming from someone he really admires. It's coming from this man who seems so strong and sturdy to him that maybe even in the back of Maverick's mind, he's like, wait a minute, Mr. Wyatt cries, you know? This is somebody who comes down on him so hard sometimes and gives him so much tough love. So for this giant of a man to give him that permission, I knew it was important, but I wanted to give the young Black men who read it permission as well, because they don't get that enough. We as a society have made young men, period, think that showing emotion is a weakness. And the fact of the matter is our emotions are one of our most powerful weapons. We see proof of it all the time. America is run by emotional people. You know, so many of our political leaders around the world, they make decisions based off of pure emotion. So powerful people, they use their emotions. So why can't we encourage young people, young men especially, to show their emotions, to show vulnerability, to show sadness, to show grief? So it's for me, it's hopefully a small part in a much bigger conversation that needs to be had. But if nothing else, I wanted to give any young man or any young person, period, who picks that book up, I wanted to give them permission to emote.
You do.
Because we don't do that enough.
Absolutely. A second last question for today, even though I want to speak to you for 2 hours. But now that we are friends, we've agreed, we've decided to be friends. I'm dictating.
Yes.
And we will have future conversations because there's so much more to explore. But for now, a second last question. The story is not didactic, which is fantastic because it's not a teaching aid. Thou shalt do this, you shall do this, or white ally. Here is your bit of anthropology to understand that Black kid at the corner. You are presenting the inner life from a first-person perspective of these characters. But it left me as a reader discombobulated is perhaps an overstatement. But on the one hand, I like it when a novel is not trying very hard to be didactic and teacher-like. On the other hand, I thought to myself, Angie, you've beautifully shown me the struggle that comes with intergenerational structural violences. The mom struggle, dad struggle, his struggle, the other characters around him. And there's a desperate part of me on behalf of us as Black people that ends the last page wondering, what happens next?
You know, I've been told that I like torturing my readers. Apparently, I've been like this since I was a kid. One of my first experiences writing, my third grade teacher allowed me to write stories for my classmates and read them every Friday. And I would always end on cliffhangers. So I've carried that on now throughout my whole writing career. With Maverick, I think we do get a bit of the rest of his story, kind of through The Hate U Give, through the eyes of his daughter, but also through the results of his children. You know, in The Hate U Give, we see that Star and Seven and Sakani are great kids and they're being raised pretty well. So we know that, you know, Maverick must have done something right at some point. He got it together at some point. But I do feel like there's room to explore more of his story and Lisa's story and King and Aisha. My ultimate hope, and what we're currently discussing, is hopefully a television show where I can explore these stories. Yes. So we can get more, because I do think it's so important that I show how he became what we see even more so. And I couldn't do it through this book like I wanted. So maybe I'll pick back up his story and write an adult novel about adult Maverick. I don't know. But for right there, I think that I wanted to end it at a point of hope. So that the 17-year-olds who do see themselves in Maverick, they read it and they decide, you know what? I don't know how his story is going to go, all the twists and turns that are coming up, but I can write my own through my life. And I can change and I can be redeemed and I can find a new path and figure out who I am for myself. So, but yeah, I hope to do a television show so that, you know, people get more answers, because that's what I've been asked a lot since this book came out. Like, okay, what's the in between? So hopefully we can get this show going to show y'all the in between.
And lastly, for purposes of library classification, or putting a book on a shelf, it has to go somewhere. I went to buy a friend a copy as a gift, and the bookstore that I went to, I looked for it. I thought, where might it be? International, Afrikaner authors, black authors, or a euphemism? And I couldn't locate it. And eventually it was found in the young adult section, which is okay, because it's a fantastic book for teenagers that struggle to read but want to see themselves in books and also want readable books. What are your thoughts on how your work is classified? Because it's double-edged, I would imagine.
It is. You know, young adult fiction catches a lot of flack. You know, when you say YA to some people, they're like, oh, Twilight. And we're so much more than just Twilight, you know, or, oh, The Hunger Games.
Because I would take your book and I would use it as if I really wanted to be a teacher about it. It raises deep identity, sociological, ethical, and a range of other questions. And my worry with the YA tag is that even a well-intentioned uncle will pick the book up as a gift for a 17-year-old, not realizing that he should have bought two, one for himself as well.
I appreciate that. I do. Yeah, that's the other part of it, because adults do write off YA. I love writing for young people. I feel like, you know, that's what I'm going to continue to do for the rest of my career, write for young people. But it does mean that people quickly write the book off, or they're like, oh, it's young adult. And I wish that they would recognize that so many of our stories, even in that genre, that category, we're exploring a multitude of things. YA is so diverse, it's becoming so much more diverse. And there's a multitude of stories, so many complex and layered stories. So my hope, and for everyone watching this, please don't write it off just because it's YA. Give it a chance.
Absolutely. Thank you for your gift, and thank you for making time for us today.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. And yes, the book is available at Exclusive Books. You can get a copy here in South Africa. Absolutely beautiful and well worth your time and your money. Coming up next is an interview, or rather a book review, that was done by Oliver Dixon about a local book that is located in Eldorado Park. Enjoy.
Hey everybody, my name is Oliver Dixon, and I'm so happy to be on Cover to Cover to talk about a book that I recently read that will stay with me for the rest of my life. Interestingly though, it's a book that I didn't actually finish and read it cover to cover. I read 2/3 into the book, and that's why I leave it. I'll tell you why I choose not to read the book to the end. But the name of the book is Those Who Live in Cages. Author's name is Terri-Ann Adams. I think this is Terry Ann's first, her debut novel. It's one hell of a debut. Fantastic story. Without giving away too much, in a nutshell, it follows the lives of a family in a colored family in Eldorado Park, a broken, blended family of sorts. And the format of this book is something I haven't yet encountered anywhere else. Terri-Ann writes it in a very interesting format. She writes it in a format that is sort of feels like a bundle of short stories put together, but it's not, because each character has a different story, but all the stories live together and come together and blend together. But the grand plot, for instance, of the book is something you build through different voices. So the narrator is not a single central narrator. The narrator is each character that exists in the book, narrates their own story and narrates their own point of view. So you get to live inside the life of the character, not through an external view into the life of the character, but by the character narrating their own story to you. And by the time you get to halfway through this book, you would have read it through the voices of 6, 7, maybe 8 different narrators, different characters, and that makes the reading experience that much more interesting. It feels like you're starting a new story each time a different character comes in, and it just keeps building and building, and it's fantastic. Amazing format. I have no idea what it's called, if there is even a name for the format, but amazing format. The reason why I didn't read this book to the end, and why I choose not to read it to the end, this book is 100% the life I lived growing up. It is so quintessentially township colored that it's exactly everything I know growing up. And the lexicon and writing style of Terry Ann is so smooth, so perfect, that when she describes things, it's not something I have to create an imagination for. It's something I would have seen, smelled, tasted, experienced. And so when she describes the meal her mom's busy cooking in the house, for instance, it's something I physically smell, because my mom would have cooked that at some point in exactly the same way as the main character in the book. Her name is Auntie Bertha. She's the matriarch. And the reason why I choose not to read the book to the end is because of Auntie Bertha. Auntie Bertha's story is 100% like my mom's story. Growing up, Auntie Bertha speaks like my mom, in the cadence my mom spoke in, the pace and tone my mom speaks in. And it's just creepy. That it's just so identical. It's creepy. Auntie Bertha, for instance, is a single mom, raising 3 kids. One is a delinquent, and Auntie Bertha, for instance, works a dead-end factory job. That's 100% my mom's life. Auntie Bertha has a 17-year-old teenage daughter, who is finishing high school. I've got a 17-year-old teenage sister finishing high school, for instance. But at some point, Auntie Bertha becomes really sick. But it never frontlines the story anyway. But it gets a mention every once in a while. And I am afraid that Auntie Bertha's illness is going to become a central part of the tail end of the book. And I'm afraid that Auntie Bertha might die. And I'm not ready to mourn Auntie Bertha's death, because it will be like mourning the death of my own mom. I'm just not emotionally ready for that. And that's why I didn't finish this book. It's just that good. I am not emotionally strong enough for that. But I think everybody should get it. You might miss a few concepts and a few things might fly over your head because of the language. It's very specifically Gauteng township colored. It's even if you're colored from like Durban, you might miss a few things. It's very specific. So like places like El Dorado Park, Ennerdale, Westbury, Tukumsinus, which is where I'm from. And this is what makes this book so uniquely rich. So get out, go out and get it. It's still in stores. It is shortlisted on the Sunday Times, shortlist, this year. And this book was introduced to me by a good friend of mine who recently passed away, Nadia Gotham, who was the publisher of this book. Nadia and I spent countless hours in the AMs just discussing this book and discussing Terry Ann's work. And I'm excited for what's to come in Terry Ann's life as an author. And yeah, go get it. Those Who Live in Cages, one of my favorites in a very long time.
And that's it for today's edition of Cover to Cover. As always, you can follow myself or Joanne Joseph on social media so that you are alerted to the next editions of the show, or go and find them on the YouTube channel of Exclusive Books. Remember, you can find these books in any of the stores nationwide. If you don't want to leave home, you can also go online to exclusivebooks.co.za. Till next time, happy reading.